My daughter started school this morning with her backpack in hand, and I know that your children or your grandchildren perhaps are going to be starting school, if not already, pretty darn soon. We're going to take a look today at what can happen if those backpacks are too heavy or not designed correctly. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. In the studio with me, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And Jill, good to see you.
Beautiful day out there.
And Lori Tyne Brody. Lori is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Lori, good to see you too.
It is great to be here. And I'm so sorry your daughter started
right.
school already.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there's a lot of kids out there today who are going,
yeah. Well, and a lot of parents out there saying, oh, I have to start getting my child on that normal sleep schedule.
Oh,
that's the other big thing is staying up late, getting up early, all that changes.
We have to get up at 5:30 in the morning.
Oh, man.
So did you transition her for a couple weeks? Did you have her start going to bed earlier and getting up earlier?
Well, she's not a late.
That's good.
Nine o'clock, she's usually ready to go to bed.
That's great.
Anyway.
I'm not transitioning my kids. It's just going to be trial by fire.
Well, what about your kids as you listen to these two experts talk? Give us a call with your own questions. We can take some other physical therapy issues as well at 1-800-642-1234. If you'd like, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Maybe you'd like to know about selecting a backpack or what other physical concerns do you have for your kids as you send them back to school. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. You know, this morning they were talking about kids in India on one of our morning shows that they have an even worse problem in India with their children because their backpacks are heavier because there are more books.
Huh.
Oh, right.
So, interesting. So, Larry, here's a quiz for you. How much should a kid's backpack weigh? Do you know?
No idea.
It's a percentage of something. I'll give you a hint.
Oh, a percentage of their weight or height?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Percentage
of their weight?
Of their body weight. Mm-hmm. Take a shot at it. What do you think it might be?
Oh, 20 pounds. If you're a 100-pound kid.
So 20% of your body weight?
Yeah.
That would be an upper limit.
Ah!
So the recommendation is, for the American Academy of Pediatrics, 10% to 20%, but really on the lower end of it, especially for a child. So if you're a fullback, you know, if you're an 18-year-old fullback, well, there's probably a little bit of leeway with that. But if you have younger children, I would say prepubescent children,
absolutely,
certainly on the lower end of that. So that's how much it should weigh. And that's an interesting concept about the how many students actually carry books versus those that do a lot of work electronically.
Right. And the interesting thing at my daughter's high school, she'll be a freshman in high school, they are all getting issued computers, Chromebooks.
Yeah.
And so
Emily has one too.
Right. And so I think that will help because a lot of the information will be done electronically. And so she won't have to carry as many books. But the other thing she did say was they never go to their locker at a larger high school because it's so far away. So they carry a backpack with all their entire day in it. So it's not like you can have the convenience of switching out books in between classes.
Right.
That option isn't always available.
Right. And I have to say, the Chromebooks are heavy.
Right.
My kids had Chromebooks last year. They are heavy. When they put those Chromebooks in their backpack and then they've got a couple of notebooks because they may be doing some work on their computer, but they are still taking notes notebooks and they have all those
and there
notebooks.
Are still books, too.
There are still books.
Absolutely.
Yes, there are. You know, and a couple other things. You know, if you get a big backpack, it's like you know, me in a large purse. You know, the bigger my purse, the more stuff I can put in it, the more room I have. Well, I'll just put this in there, too. Same is true for kids. The bigger their backpack, the more things they're going to start to stuff in it. So make sure you get a backpack that seems to be an appropriate size for your child. And then when your child's wearing it, really put it on. both straps on both shoulders. I mean, how many times do you see kids walking down the street with a backpack flung over one shoulder? So that
all the time.
Yeah, all
well,
the time.
And the strap's not adjusted appropriately, so the weight of the backpack is really, really low. It's not even sitting on their back. So it's slung over. The straps aren't adjusted to the appropriate length, and the backpack is sitting way, way low. And so all of those things can result in low back, neck, or shoulder pain.
Rachel Absolutely. In Fort Atkinson has something that relates to this. We may have answered part of her question already. Rachel, hi.
Hi. I have a two-part question. How much should a backpack weigh, and what's a good type of backpack for a high school or college student?
Well, I'll take that because since I have high school and college kids. And back to how much should a backpack weigh? Again, we're back at the 10 to a maximum of 20% of their body weight. As a mother of high schoolers and a college son who had a backpack that I swore weighed 50 pounds, what I found was the straps would break all the time. So instead of getting, you know, going to the regular store and getting the garden variety school backpack for all of my kids, I have now gone to an outdoor outfitter right. and gotten a day pack. And mm-hmm. they make them that carry laptops. And what I look for are straps that are really heavy duty and really well attached to the backpack. Because if your kid is like many and they fling it over one arm, they're going to be stressing one strap of the backpack. And also the handle where you pick it up, make sure it's really solid and firmly attached. Just it's a really substantive backpack. And I found that those will last for years, whereas the other ones, halfway through the school year, the straps are broken off.
Absolutely. And typically those outdoor type backpacks come with straps that attach together in the front. So there's usually a waistband and a strap at about the chest where you can buckle the two vertical straps together. And we highly recommend using those. Kids don't like to use them. As Lori said, they fling them over their shoulder. But to distribute that weight more evenly, especially for a college student who may have a 10 or 15 minute walk between classes, to take the time to do those straps is really essential. It will balance the load that they're carrying much better.
Mm-hmm. Right. It'll bring it a little more to the front instead of it constantly pulling them backwards.
Right.
And then the waist strap that Jill mentioned is not a small thing either. It can set some of the weight on your waistband, so on your waist and hips, so that it's not all pulling on your shoulder and upper back, giving you that shoulder pain.
Yeah. Rachel, does that help?
Yes, thank you so much.
Yeah,
Good luck. Thanks
a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Wow, we went through quite a few things. You know, the backpacks themselves typically don't weigh anything.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
Nothing,
yeah. Generally, but the backpacks aren't that heavy.
The biggest thing that I find is my children neglect to clean their backpack out. So
yeah.
there's the three partially full water bottles in mm-hmm. it that just adds mm-hmm. weight. And so getting after them to clean it out every day and make sure there's nothing excess in there is also very important.
What about, you know, yesterday we were went to a sporting goods store to get some shoes.
Oh, yeah.
Some new shoes. And shoes, tennis shoes, as they all wear, everybody wears tennis shoes.
Yeah. We were at the shoe store yesterday, too.
I think that's kind of important, too.
It's really important, and because that's part of the whole back to school is new clothes, new backpacks, and many times new shoes because children outgrow their shoes during the summer. So you buy this brand new pair of shoes and you wear them to school the very first day after you've probably walked about 15 feet in them in the store. And then you may walk to the bus stop, walk into school, and you may walk 2 or 3 miles around school in these brand new shoes before you hadn't really kind of broken them in or gotten them used to you. So we always encourage people, you always want to wear your brand new shoes that very first day of school, but we encourage the kids to wear them around the house a little bit and kind of get used to them. Make sure there's no issues. Make sure you have them laced appropriately. Make sure they're tight enough. Make sure you have good socks with them before you go that very first day of school. Otherwise, you'll end up with blisters or sore feet.
And I'll throw in one of my big pet peeves about kids and shoes, and that is the control of your foot motion and your foot stability comes from your heel. So when kids take their shoes on and off without untying them and they just slide their foot in and they break down the back of the shoe, it's called the counter of the shoe. When they break that down and it's no longer firm and supportive, that shoe loses all of its foot control and foot support. So it's really important to untie your shoes and put them on without breaking down the back of the shoe.
So I used to work, I worked in a shoe store in high school.
Oh, I remember that.
And we would have people come in and complain that, you know, these shoes are just falling apart. We can't understand why these shoes are falling apart. And they'd bring them in and the shoes would still be tied with no one's feet in them. And we'd say to them, well, does your child untie or unlace your their shoes when they take them off? Oh, always. And we would always say, well, then why are they tied right now? So it's a habit that's easy to get into. It's fast. It's quick. But really encourage your children to untie their shoes when they take them off.
Well, I bought new shoes for myself, too.
Good for you.
Oh, good for you.
And so, and I did not break them in, and I walked the mile over here. But
okay, we'll see how they go. Good.
They
it's back to school for you, too?
But
it
I always untie.
Good for you.
All right.
Untie.
Good for you.
Well, Emily is has her first cross-country practice. Of course, she's been running all summer.
Good.
All,
good
so
for her.
Forth,
good.
That just brings up this whole business of sports. Lots of kids participating. Anything about preventing injuries for those in sports?
Well, it's a little too late for the fall sports
now
because they're in full swing. We usually encourage people to kind of start ramping back up their cardiovascular activity and things like that in July to prepare for a fall sport. But those people who are not participating in fall sports and are starting to gear up for winter sports in the next few weeks or so, it'd be important to start getting your cardiovascular base going and kind of getting in the routine of doing some exercise so you enter your winter sport with a good baseline cardiovascular strength.
Yeah, you know, typically those in high school sports have some structure. You know, it's a little bit easier for the winter and spring sports because those students are a captive audience in school and the coach is getting them into a weight training class, starting some early training, or maybe they're already in a fall sport and they're getting conditioned. The hardest part is for those fall sports because the kids are really on their own. Now, I know a lot of sports, for example, soccer and football, have captain's practice where the kids show up in the summer and they do some training, and that's probably true of cross country as well.
Yes,
so,
it is.
But yeah, for those winter sports, hopefully the coaches are getting them back into some sort of an exercise routine soon.
The other thing with fall sports is we've had a really mild August. And so hopefully we aren't going to have any heat issues coming up. It's been a really mild August. Looking, the 10-day forecast still looks pretty mild. So, but that's something else you need to be cognizant of. If we get a couple really hot days and people have to train or perform and we haven't had a lot, that's something else to be really cognizant of, that people go into those days very well hydrated. People are keeping an eye on them, making sure we don't have any heat issues.
It always depends on the injury, I guess. But if a child does have an injury, what's your advice for making sure it's safe for them to start playing again? I know at Emily's school at Lakeside, there are very strict protocols about it.
But exactly. Hopefully, most high schools will have access to an athletic trainer that can help kind of guide those return to play decisions. If it's a major injury, typically a physician will be involved and will work with a physical therapist or an athletic trainer to kind of design a return to sport program or activity for that individual. You know, if it's a muscle strain kind of thing, those are usually somewhat what we call symptom limited. So you may participate in half the practice or certain drills in the practice. And that usually comes at the discretion of the athletic trainer or physical therapist that's at the high school.
All right. We have Nick in Appleton. We'll get to you in just a second. About a reminder here, our two guests today, we're taking your questions about physical therapy. We've talked a bit about back to school, but we'll take other questions as well at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer today, Joe Nadeau, our producer, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Answering your physical therapy questions today, Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health spine physical therapy clinic. Jill is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Call in 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Nick in Appleton. Nick, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hey, actually, we're heading down to Wisconsin Dells before school, but I'm a really bad employee at work. We lift really heavy things. Well, felt something tear in my shoulder, and I'm like, I don't want to have surgery because I left me at work. And, you know, I'm Irish, so forget that. But how long will that actually take to heal? Because it's been like 3 years, and I've got pretty good mobility, but if I do something stupid like I always do, it hurts again. So,
yeah.
Do you know what you tore or injured in your shoulder, Nick?
I do not. I just know that I can't raise my hand my arm very high over my head. And now, actually, I can raise my hand over my head a little bit better. But like I said, if I do something with that shoulder, it'll definitely have a little bit of pain to it yet. I'm thinking I need surgery, but I'm greedy. I don't want to take the time off.
Well, you know, that window may have closed depending upon what you tore.
Absolutely.
So if you tore something like your rotator cuff, may I ask how old you are?
I'm really old. Actually, I'm 48 as of today.
Oh. Happy birthday.
Oh, should we sing?
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, in your age group and your line of work, if you had an acute rotator cuff tear, that was probably repairable at the time. It will no longer be repairable. So now what you're doing 3 years down the road is you have what you have, and you can work to strengthen the muscles around your shoulder. But you've sort of, by not seeking help at that time, sort of created the situation that you're in now. And there's not a lot to be done. You know, potentially there could be a surgery for you down the line if you develop, for example, say hypothetically you tore your rotator cuff. What we see in people long term who have a complete rotator cuff tear is fairly significant arthritis in their shoulder. So at some point you may need surgery to deal with that. But at this point, really, you're sort of left with strengthening what remains.
Right. And it sounds like if you're going to the Dells with your kids, you're still active. It sounds like you have some work demands. So seeing a physical therapist up in Appleton, even for a couple visits to give you recommendations for exercises that you could do at home. I understand you want to minimize how much time you miss work. To get to kind of meet you where you are and make sure that you maintain your mobility and maintain and or improve your strength for the length of time of work and activity for you, I think would be great.
Yeah, and I understand that you do a lot of heavy lifting, and what people say is, well, geez, I'm already doing all this lifting all day with my shoulder. Why do I need to do more strengthening? And the answer to that is you're using the same muscles over and over again when you're doing the lifting at work. What we're trying to do is train some of the other muscles that play a supportive role. Because what we see happens over time is that you subtly change how you do things to accommodate the weaknesses that you have. And then you start to overload your upper back and you end up with upper back problems or low back problems because you change your mechanics and so on. So we're really looking at preventing some of the secondary problems that may show up because of a primary shoulder problem, if that makes sense.
I hope that helps, Nick. Thank you so much for calling. Have fun today.
Great day to be at the Dells.
And happy birthday. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. What are you seeing this time of the year as we get into the fall season? What kinds of ailments and so forth are showing up in your
what I'm seeing in my practice is people who have had elective surgeries. So, for example, they may have wanted to get through the winter. They didn't want to have their knee replacement or their hip replacement in the winter where they had to deal with ice and snow. So around springtime, they'll decide to have these surgeries, and then they come in and they're in for rehabilitation now following that. We're also seeing people who have gotten more active because the weather's been nice, and maybe they were out doing something and they took a fall, or they fell off their bike, or, you know, they were hiking and they slipped and took a fall there. So we're seeing people who have sustained injuries as a fallout from different kinds of accidents related. Also seeing people who have been somewhat inactive over the winter. And now they're coming, they're starting a running program or training for that triathlon or whatever, and they're getting injured.
And in my world, with athletics, we are, well, we have all of our fall sports are full go right now. So we have a lot of teams that are practicing a couple times a day. So the volume and the intensity of training is quite high. So we're trying to get people kind of through this, because once school starts, the volume and intensity of sports goes down because they don't have time. They can only train once a day. So that helps tremendously. We're also looking at designing some prevention programs for some of our teams, some of our winter teams and spring sports who train in the fall but don't really compete until spring. We're kind of reflecting back on last year, and we noticed that there was a trend of with a certain team crew, we had a lot of athletes with low back pain, which doesn't surprise anybody.
No.
But we also found that we have a lot of girls who just don't recruit their muscles correctly. So we're sitting down with the coaches, and we're kind of going to design kind of a prevention type program, or a training of the glutes, if you will, type of exercise program, so we can hopefully prevent some injuries. So based on previous data, we're moving forward and changing some things.
Do you work at all with, Jill, with high schools or other that have athletic programs?
I don't work with any high schools that have athletic programs. First of all, it's a conflict of interest because they're of recruitable age for collegiate work with high school kids. Anybody of the age of 14 or higher is considered of recruitable age. And so for us, there's a limit on how much we can communicate, exchange knowledge, things like that with the high schools. But Lori, where she works, there's an outreach program with many athletic trainers that cover a lot of high schools in the area.
Right. The UW Sports Medicine Center has a large outreach program that provides athletic trainers to a large number of area high schools. And depending upon the contract with the school, they will visit the school anywhere from 2 to 5 times per week. And they will see athletes who have been injured. And typically there's a sign up process, and the athletic trainer goes in and sees them and evaluates the injury, designs rehabilitation programs, gives advice about whether or not they can return to sport, whether they need to see a physician, the magnitude of the injury, the prognosis, you know, for the coach, and return to sport criteria, the whole ball of wax. And that's a really remarkable program that's been around for, I don't know, 35, 40 years, probably since Brad Sherman started it way back in the day.
Helpful program for sure. Let's take some calls. Rita in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance now. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I want to thank you for the backpack information. I have a grandson going off to college. He was going to use his old high school backpack, and I encouraged him to get one with a waist.
Great.
Oh, very good.
Because he's going to be walking longer distances.
Absolutely.
With stuff in. So thank you for that. But my call is more specifically about myself. I was one of the people who waited till spring to have a total knee replacement. And now I am dealing with, and it started when I was in rehab for my knee, IT band issues. I mean, my IT, everything's great about my knee now, but my IT band still acts up. It goes all the way down to my toes, from across my buttocks and hips down to my toes. And I've tried chiropractic. The physical therapist didn't have much to say to me about it at the time, and I'm just tired of it. It's been weeks.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So IT band pathology typically doesn't go all the way down to your toes. It typically stops at your knees. When you think about something going all the way down to your toes, can you describe those symptoms?
It's just...
tingling? Or?
It's like an ache.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like an ache, and no, not a tingling. I have lots of nerve regeneration that is tingling, but this is different.
What's the nerve regeneration from, Rita?
Well, from the total knee replacement. I I have lots of nerve regeneration.
Okay. All right. So,
does the position of your back make a difference in your pain going down the outside of your leg?
You know, I only feel it when I'm sitting.
Yep. Okay.
I feel it sometimes when I'm standing, but not much. Okay. I went to the gym and they told me to do some stretching with that weight on my ankle.
And some traction.
That didn't seem to help.
Mm-hmm. It sounds a little bit sciatica-ish.
Me too. Yeah.
And so with sitting, it can be coming from your back because of the compressive loads in your back as you're sitting. We see that fairly often. People tend to have a lot of back problems, for example, in driving because they sit for prolonged periods of time with their leg out and a little bit of stretch on their sciatic nerve. And that would be consistent with going all the way down your foot. You could also be some sciatica coming from your piriformis muscle in your butt because you're sitting right on your sciatic nerve. You know, when they do that knee replacement, it's a bit like a construction site. So, you know, there's a lot of movement and stuff that happens in your back and hip. And so it's not unusual for us to see a flare of symptoms more proximal or farther up the kinetic chain after one of these joint replacement surgeries. So I'd do some stretching around your hip, particularly your piriformis, and some stretching for your back and some mobility for your back and some core work and see if that helps. And you could go back to your physical therapist and have them examine you, but Jill's right. Iliotibial band doesn't go down to your toes. It stops on the outside of your knee.
Rita, does that help?
Muscular.
What's that?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
You're very
Good
welcome.
Good luck.
Michael in Milton will turn to you now. Hi, Michael.
All right. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My call is about sort of like the course of what I guess is maybe a garden variety ankle sprain. It's my left ankle. And by the way, I'm 60 years old, and one of the things that's really discouraging is you get injured by sitting. But so I changed my chair recently, and it rotates. And I think I tore a bunch of ligaments, and now I'm on – or sprained it. So now I'm on day 16, and initially the outside of my left foot was sore, and now it's just like in the back of my heel. It's not the Achilles. It's not like under the heel like plantar fasciitis. I'm just curious, does that sound like a normal course of – healing? I didn't do anything special in terms of treatment.
Well, tell us again what happened. We were confused a little bit about the sitting on the chair thing.
Sure. So I switched from a recliner to a chair that swivels and it rolls. And I think I was like planting my feet and rolling and going from side to side. And I think I did it too hard once or, you know, too hard a bunch of times. I mean, I never heard anything pop. But my foot hurt, and now it's a little bit swollen.
Okay.
I think it sounds like an overuse.
Yeah, like a perineal tendonitis.
Like an inversion, eversion, overuse kind of thing. Okay, so we were thinking there was more of a one-time episode, but it sounds to me like this was like a repeated side-to-side movement. Is that right, Michael?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense.
So, and you said it's now a little bit behind your heel on, or excuse me, behind that bone on the outside, but it's not your Achilles?
No.
Okay.
That would be the peroneus longus. Yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like you got a little bit of what we call peroneal tendonitis or a peroneal tendon irritation. And those muscles, especially with your foot planted, kind of help roll your ankle in and out. So if you're doing a lot of rotating in your chair and if you're pushing more on that left side for whatever reason, you could have given yourself a little peroneal overuse injury. So from a treatment perspective, things that would help would be some icing. So you could do a little ice cup and literally rub it around that area for 5 to 7 minutes. You could do some easy range of motion. For example, drawing the alphabet with your toes just to kind of keep the mobility around. And then limit how much you're doing this pushing or this rotation.
Yeah. And then as you get better, as things start to recover, you could put the outside of your foot against a stationary object and just push gently. Or the other way to think about it is to cross your ankles, cross your legs at your ankles, and push the outside border of your ankles together gently to strengthen those muscles.
And would you write the alphabet or print the alphabet with your phone?
So that's always a great question. And I tell people to use capital letters. And big capital letters,
uppercase.
Just to get the big motion.
Mm-hmm. Capital letters.
Mm-hmm. Or they could write the Gettysburg Address. I always tell people they could do that.
Cursive or print, I don't care.
Doesn't matter. Okay. Nope. Michael, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Kent in Reedstown next. Hi, Kent.
Yeah, hi. In April, I fell kind of flat on my right arm, and I had the doctor look at it, the x-ray, there's no problem there, and he just kind of recommended doing circular motions with my shoulder, and I've been doing that pretty well. And it is getting better. I'm 71, so I know it's going to take longer to heal. But where it's really weak is like if I'm just sitting in a chair and I just want to lift my arm up, just that that movement from the armrest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So it sounds to me like you had probably a more significant injury. X-rays, nothing's broken, but it sounds to me like you probably tore your rotator cuff when
you
fell on it.
Injury.
You have some soft tissue muscular injury, and it's been 5 months, and you can't raise your arm. You need to see physical therapy and have them examine your shoulder. So there's a couple. Well, let me ask you this. If you took your other arm and your left arm and tried to lift your right arm, can you get it overhead?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I can get it overhead. All right. I don't have the strength.
You don't have the strength.
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So you need to get to physical therapy and have them examine your shoulder. So one of the things we worry about is a frozen shoulder. But if you can get your left arm fully overhead and behind your back, then it's probably not developing a frozen shoulder. But that's a significant secondary outcome that we worry about here. But you definitely need to get in to see somebody. You're already 5 months down the road. If you were going to be better, you would be better by now.
Right.
So I would get in as soon as possible and have someone start working on that shoulder to get some strength back if it's recoverable at this point.
Right.
Kent, does that help?
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Talking physical therapy today, all those aches and pains and sprains and strains with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Great to have them with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in at 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. Gloria emailed to say she'd like to start a running program. She just walks right now. Where should she start? She doesn't want to injure herself.
That's great that she's looking forward to kind of advancing her physical fitness and that she's already started a walking program. So walking and running are a little bit different. You do use your muscles differently. My suggestion would be to do an intermittent walk-jog type of program and to either do it on the surface she's already doing it on or to go to a high school track. High school tracks are great because if you need to take a break, you're not that far from your car. It's not an out and back. And so those work really well.
Yeah, I totally agree. A high school track is my favorite go-to place because it's cushioned and it's really easy. You can say, all right, I'm gonna walk the curves and I'm going to jog the straightaways, and you can, it's really easy to measure your distance and time and see how much you're walking and how much you're jogging. It's a great way to get yourself built up and get a rhythm for that. So I would just say our rule of thumb is you have to train at the same level for 3 consecutive training sessions before you increase. So it's not like you start off doing a walk jog, like you walk one of the one of the lengths now and then. Oh, next time I'm going to double that. I'm going to walk each of, or I'm going to run each of the straightaways.
Right.
Or I'm going to increase my speed 3 sessions in a row before you go up.
And a good rule of thumb is increasing once she gets going and she wants to kind of increase things 10% a week, or the aggressive end is 5% a day.
All right.
So just don't go much and respond to your body. See how you feel. But I do like the walking the curves because it uses your muscles very differently on the curve. Mm-hmm. So running the straightaways and walking the curves is a great strategy to start with on a high school track.
Jackie in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jackie.
Hi there. So I actually was thrown off of a mechanical bull about a month ago and landed on my left side, kind of on my arm and elbow. And for about a week afterwards, I had, you know, some discomfort, almost like bruising in my elbow. And since then, like everyday pain is gone. But if I like lean on my elbow or put pressure on it, I still have quite a bit of discomfort. I'm just wondering if this is something that kind of heals on its own, if I should get it checked out.
So how do you do with rotating your palm up and down?
Rotating palm up
and
down?
Like to start a car, turn a doorknob.
Turn a doorknob, things like that.
Yeah, no issues there.
So okay. It's just pressure.
Yeah.
It's just pressure.
Yeah.
Is it thick?
Like if I'm adjusting myself in bed or sort of like leaning onto it.
Does it feel thicker and boggy? Because there's a very large bursa there that you could have irritated as well.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
Does your elbow feel like, if you feel that bone on your elbow, does it feel thicker on that side or kind of boggy? Does it feel like there's a little balloon of fluid in there?
No, not really. It feels mostly normal. It's just that bit of pain.
Okay. And where is the pain? Where in your elbow is the pain?
Like kind of right on the pointy part, almost.
On the pointy part. Okay, right on the olecranon. Okay. Well, it could still be a bone bruise. Mm-hmm. And bone bruises take a long time to heal. The thing about your elbow and that bony prominence is it's really prominent. And there's really only skin over it. People don't have generally fat on their elbows or muscle across their elbow joint that provides any kind of cushion. So I would say to ice it and make sure you maintain full motion of your elbow. You can do a little strengthening around your elbow and see if over time it doesn't improve. If it doesn't, you know, the only things that really happen right at the tip of your elbow are olecranon fractures, and you'd have more pain probably if
Absolutely.
You had a fracture there. The other thing is a radial head fracture, but that's not where you're hurting. So so we would probably at this point chalk it up to a bone bruise and just know it's going to take a while to get better.
There you go, Jackie. Thank you for calling. Stay off those
mechanical bulls.
I think I know where she did that.
we haven't had one of those injuries for a while, mechanical bull injury.
There's a restaurant in town that has one now.
Oh.
Oh, geez. Isn't that like a 70s thing?
I don't know.
Oh. Well, what does Susan
goes around comes around.
What's Susan got for us in Mineral Point? Hi, Susan.
Hi. I have been treating a frozen shoulder for more than a year now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I actually started, I think, too early.
Okay.
I'm a diabetic, long-term type 1 diabetic, and I started noticing discomfort in my shoulder, and I thought, well, I better be proactive about this. And so I started more than a year ago, and it actually got worse.
Yeah.
And I was told through PT that it goes through these stages.
That's correct.
And I think I'm frozen.
Okay.
But I, you know, I'm hopeful that there's a thawing out. I'm just wondering because, you know, this is really costly. You know, I used up my insurance 2 years in a row now for PT, 20 visits. And then I continue to see anywhere from, well, now it's once a week I see PT, but I'm wondering how I can save on the cost, and is it ever going to get better? And also, is there a surgery that can be done?
Great questions.
Whatever.
We can answer all those.
Yep, those are all really good questions and thoughts. So the three stages of the frozen shoulders you had mentioned is the freezing stage, which is when it's usually very painful and uncomfortable. And that is when you start getting worse, to kind of when you hit rock bottom, for lack of better terms, when you are frozen. And your chief complaint there is just lack of motion, to the thawing stage where you start regaining motion and you really only have pain when you do those specific stretching maneuvers. So from a cost perspective, if you're kind of stuck in the frozen stage and you're not seeing gains or benefits in your mobility with physical therapy, I would put your PT on hold, just maintaining what you have at home with a well-designed home exercise program. And then once you feel like my shoulder is thawing and it's starting to loosen up and now I need hands-on manual therapy from my physical therapist, would I go back?
Right. And I agree with that. There's not evidence. There's no evidence that shows that ongoing physical therapy in those early stages changes the longevity or the outcomes of a frozen shoulder, particularly in someone with diabetes. You will transition through these stages whether you're seeing somebody on a regular basis or whether you're doing the work mostly on your own. The key is you have to keep doing it to try to maintain the motion that you have. But I would save those visits, as Jill said, for the thawing stage. And, you know, 18 to probably 24 months
for a diabetic,
for someone with diabetes, is what you're looking at.
And
so
I will tell you, as a physical therapist, there is nothing worse than seeing a patient who you had mentioned too early, in that freezing stage as they're kind of getting worse and knowing that there's really nothing you can do to correct this, that, you know, the train has become derailed and it keeps going. It's a really hard thing to see as a PT. With regards to surgery, these are best managed conservatively, especially in patients with diabetes. The outcomes are no better for people who have surgery than people who don't. There's multiple surgical options out there and none of them are better than kind of writing this out, if you will.
There are some cases where people are, perhaps they had an overuse injury or had a fall and they're starting to lose mobility, who benefit from a cortisone injection early on. And that can jumpstart their motion and prevent the progression into a frozen shoulder. But that's a select case.
There we go.
Cases, yep. So.
Good luck, Susan. Thank you for calling. Let's give Erica in Eau Claire a chance next. Hi, Erica.
Hi. So I have a question. I just started an office job, so I'm sitting 8 hours a day now, which I hadn't been that sedentary before. And my right hip is just on fire for most of the day. And I don't know, when I walk, I figured it was because I'm not doing as much activity. So I try to walk, but then a 15-minute walk, I'm in pain and I can't push my leg off because there's so much pain now. So I'm not sure if I need to rest more, but that seems counterproductive because I'm sitting all the time.
Right.
Or if it stretches.
So where in your hip is your pain?
It's on the outside, kind of closer to the butt area, I guess.
Okay. Kind of on, like, on the outside, on a bony area, would you say? Is there a bone under it?
Right below that, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you another weird question. When you're sitting, do you cross your legs?
No, I don't.
Okay, good. Good, good, good. Okay, because I'm trying to figure out why right side versus left. So
Does
the pain stay right in that area or does it go down your leg?
Stays in that spot, in that spot.
Sounds to me like greater trochanteric bursitis.
Can you put your finger on it? And it's very tender to the touch. Can you put your finger on that spot that hurts? That's probably the most likely culprit. The question is why one than the other? And it may be how you're sitting in your chair. It may be, you know, you're pressing or you're leaning one direction and putting more pressure on that one. Sometimes the chairs
can't
a little bit and they roll you in and so you internally rotate at your hips a little bit and that annoys it. So Stretching around your glutes is good. You know what I'd probably do? I'd probably get a resistive band, a loop, and put it around your knees and work on pulling your knees apart while you sit in a chair to work your glutes and keep your knees farther apart.
Yes, but I would see a physical therapist for this because they can give you a few tools or tricks. And, you know, you want to stay active. It sounds like you want to walk and do these things, which is great to combat the sedentariness of a job. They may need to look at how you sit in your chair. They may recommend a lumbar roll. I would say a few visits with a physical therapist would help. And one of the things they'd probably implement would be that band that when you sit, you have to pull apart to kind of engage your gluteal muscles while you're sitting. But that's what it sounds like to me.
Good luck, Erica. Thank you so much for calling. Elvira in Houston, Minnesota, your turn now. Hi.
Hi. My question is, my daughter has just been diagnosed with slipping rib syndrome, and we're having our first therapy in a couple of days. But I'm wondering if there's anything else we can do for the pain besides ibuprofen and ice and heat.
How old is she, by the way?
She is 14.
Okay. So how did this all start? Can you give us a little more background?
Yeah, she started about a year ago. She would complain of getting short of breath when she exercised. And about 2 months ago, she said, I think my rib popped. And, you know, at first I didn't believe her, of course. But
Who believes a 14-year-old girl?
Right.
I have one at home.
Yeah. And then she said, and I have a lot of back pain, and the back pain had been going for a while. I did take her to the doctor, and she had diagnosed herself actually by Googling all her symptoms.
Right.
and the doctor did agree, but you know, there isn't much that we know that she can do besides the breathing exercises. You know, we have done some research, but and then finally, she's in volleyball, so the pain has been. With practices have been increasing a little bit.
Does she have problems with any other joints besides her back and this difficulty breathing or flank pain?
No, not really.
Okay. All right. So, you know, slipping rib is your lower three ribs are not attached to your sternum like the upper ribs are, so they're a little more likely to shift or move out of place. And the question is why they're doing that, whether there's something about her anatomy, whether she has some generalized joint hypermobility, which is sort of where I was going with this. If she tends to have loose connective tissue, if she's really excessively flexible. And if that's the case, you really want to look at this from a systemic perspective, not just from the rib perspective. But really, it sounds like she's going to see a physical therapist, which is great. Then they should be working on looking at her breathing and making sure she's doing symmetric diaphragmatic breathing, not just breathing from her stomach or breathing from a rib cage, which is fairly common in people, especially if you're athletic, it's your secondary source of breathing, but really teaching her good diaphragmatic breathing and breathing symmetrically on both sides so she's not excessively loading one side of her rib cage or another. And then thereafter, it's going to be strengthening around her rib cage and core to try to stabilize there.
She doesn't have any curves in her back, any scoliosis. Did the doctor look very thoroughly for that?
They have looked.
Okay. Okay.
And
all right.
No, she has.
Great.
No.
Great. Okay. Because that could also be a contributing factor. So it's great that you're keeping a close eye on that as well.
Yeah. So we just look at other factors that may have preceded the slipping rib to make sure there's not an underlying issue that's been missed. If all those other things have been ruled out, then you treat it as a slipping rib with the core strengthening, the breathing, and so on.
There you go. Thanks, Elvira, for calling. Good luck to you and your daughter. Beverly in Laval, I'm sorry.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. A little over a year ago, I was walking down the stairs and my knee literally gave out, and I couldn't put any weight on my foot. Ended up at the ER, and they diagnosed me with severe tendonitis and put me on some muscle, just like ibuprofen. Mm-hmm. And
And within the end of the week, I was able to walk again, and that eventually subsided, and I ended up with a large Baker cyst on the back of my knee, which popped, and then I had a swollen ankle, and so all that subsided, but now every once in a while I have, and the knee went out for no reason whatsoever. I had no warning; it just went out. And so now I every once in a while I have that same sensation, like there's a weakness in the knee or a little bit of tenderness. And I'm wondering what might have caused initially, and if there's some therapy I could be doing now that perhaps should be strengthening the tendon. I'm incredibly active. I walk a lot. And so it's not like I'm sitting. Well, I sit a lot too, but you know, at my desk, but I walk a lot also.
So when you say your knee kind of gave out or went out, did your kneecap slide in and out, or did you just feel like the muscles stopped working? Can you explain that a little bit more?
The leg just literally, I stepped on the stair and it collapsed. Fell.
Yep. Okay.
So we're going to talk about this, I think, over the break, but we're feeling like potentially when you step down, because you were stepping down and rotating over your knee, that you may have injured a meniscus, which would be consistent with the Baker cyst.
Yep.
Those tend to happen when you tear a meniscus. Yeah. And the tendonitis may have been secondary, or you may have had that as well, but it probably wasn't the primary issue that caused your knee to give way.
And we can talk some more about that after we take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. We'll take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along as we talk physical therapy with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. Great to have you with us. And we had Beverly from Laval on, who took a step on the stairs and her knee just gave out.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's not that common for that kind of a mechanism for tendonitis. Tendonitis tends to be an overuse injury, and she is a walker. But usually what will happen is you'll feel pain. You'll have a sharp stabbing pain or something like that, and then your knee will give way. Her knee just gave way. And then down the road, she developed a Baker cyst, which is a cyst in the back of the knee, a little pocket of swelling. You don't get a Baker cyst from tendonitis.
Right.
So we're wondering if she somehow caught her meniscus when she was going down the stairs and then caused that fall or whatever, and then subsequently developed a Baker cyst, which is not uncommonly associated with a meniscus tear.
Right. And she had also mentioned that sometimes she feels this uneasiness in her knee, which may be part of an unhealed meniscus or a little irritation of that meniscus. So it sounds like she's active and she wants to remain active. So just because you have a tear in your meniscus does not mean you need surgery. Many meniscal tears heal on their own. So we're not saying surgery is the way to go, but I would see a physical therapist to make sure that you have adequate strength in the muscles around your knee joint. We know that you can offload the load that goes through the joint itself by up to about 70% if you have really good strength in your musculature around your knee, your quadriceps and hamstrings. So seeing a PT for a really nice home exercise program that would keep you active and keep her strong to maintain her walking program, I think would be very important.
Indeed, and especially if she also has tendonitis.
Right, absolutely.
So we need to get that treated she, you know, what'll happen is she'll change how she walks and so on, and then she'll start having hip problems or back problems or other knee problems and so on. So,
yep,
I get into PT and have them take a look at that knee.
Victoria in Antioch, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Victoria.
Hi. I have three compression fractures in the lumbar area since May, and I didn't know if physical therapy would help with that. I had an MRI. I saw a neurosurgeon, that, you know, it suggested having chiropractic, and I'm just a little concerned about having that done, and I thought about seeing an orthopedic surgeon just to see what's going on with the bones, and I had a bone density a year ago in April, and my doctor, my primary physician, said that it didn't show to where I should be having these kind of fractures. And so basically I had a viral infection, was coughing a lot and bent over, and that's when the first compression fracture happened in May.
Okay.
So I'm glad that you've been worked up and looked at for osteopenia or osteoporosis, because three compression fractures in a short amount of time would suggest that that is an issue. So you've had these compression fractures are relatively new. It sounds like your bone density was over a year ago. Is that right?
Yes.
So you may want to talk about repeating that. I don't know if something has changed. But in answer to your original question, yes, physical therapists do work with that. And specifically, my recommendation would be use of a pool where we can unload those fractures. So basically, you want your core to be strong so that your muscles can support your back and not rely on the static structure of your spine to be the primary supporting mechanism. So we work really hard to get you up straight, to work on the muscles in your back, in your abdominal muscles, your hips, and so on, so that they can help support your spine and not rely on the bony structure itself. So I would see somebody and see if you can't get in a pool to start doing some strengthening exercises.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Victoria. Alice in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Alice.
Hi. I have an issue when I ride in the car, and it's kind of opposite of what most people have, because it's when I'm the passenger in the car and not the driver. And I get sore. It kind of starts up in my back behind my scapula, like my muscle tightens up really much there. And then eventually when I'm in the car long enough, it will go down my arm and into my bicep area, kind of.
Yeah.
So it sounds like that's almost coming from your neck.
So is it one specific car, or is it any car you sit in?
It's almost any car, and it's only for, like, if I'm trying to, I just drove home from Colorado, and by the time I got home to my house after 3 days in the car, I was ready to scream.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you a weird question. So when you're driving, you always have to look straight ahead. When you're the passenger, are you turning your neck to chat with the driver or turning your head to do the radio or anything like that?
Rarely, no.
No? Okay. You're always looking straight ahead?
Well, I mean, I'm sure I do turn my head at some point, but okay, it's not like it's turned full time.
Okay.
So I wonder if it has to do with the position of the seat and perhaps the headrest, if it's putting you in an awkward position, or if the sort of the opposite of what Jill has said, as the driver, you potentially turn your head a little more to check your mirrors, things like that, that maybe you're not moving your neck as much. But the symptoms you describe are clearly from your neck. So they'll go down into your shoulder blades and down into your arms. So there's something about the position of your head and neck when you're the passenger in the car. And I can't tell you exactly what it is, but, you know, trying to readjust yourself, see if there's a different position, sitting up more, sitting back more, looking at your head position. It could also be when you're the driver, you've adjusted your mirror such that you're sitting up a little bit straighter, but when you're the passenger, you may slouch a little more. So those are just speculations.
Right. It may be worth trying a lumbar roll. And I know that sounds weird because we're talking about this coming from your neck, but the lumbar roll, a small towel roll in the low part of your back, would force you to sit up a little taller as the passenger and may put you in that better stacked alignment that Lori was talking about. So you may just want to start with a small towel and roll it up and put it behind your back when you're the passenger and see if that makes a difference.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Alice. Appreciate it very much. Carrie, back to shoes for a minute here. Carrie emailed that one point she likes to recommend to parents is to get their kids tying their shoes very early on in their lifetime so they get used to it. A child who can tie their shoes carefully but not quickly may opt not to slip them on and off instead of, you know, when they're changing shoes during school time, maybe to gym shoes or whatever. They need the practice, and if they're doing it early on, they're going to be more likely to keep doing it.
Right, right. So there's that rush to get outside for recess or to get to gym or whatever. So just encouraging them to tie them and learning early on.
It's great practice. Just like my daughter had to practice with her padlock for school when she got her new locker padlock. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. This is a really important thing for young children to practice. So that's a great point.
Just to go along with it, Marilyn emailed that she's noticed students, and I see this too, wearing their shoes untied.
Oh, yeah.
That can't be good, Marilyn says. And what about wearing flip-flops?
Well, first of all, let's go to the tennis shoe business. And yes, to really get the benefits of the shoe, like Lori talked about, with that heel counter being supportive, you need to tie your shoes. If I had a nickel for every time an athlete walked in the athletic training room to do rehab on their lower extremity with their shoes untied, yeah, I could retire. I have to tell them, tie your shoes. And so, you know, it ascends all the way through college level. So if you're going to wear tennis shoes, please, please, please take the time to tie them.
So flip-flops. You know, generally flip-flops provide no support, no shock absorption. They would be sort of the summer version of a minimalist shoe. So, you know, some people can get away with wearing them and they don't bother their feet and it helps strengthen their arches. Other people, it wreaks havoc with their lower extremity posture and creates all kinds of problems. So there's not a one size fits all to say, oh, flip-flops are terrible, no one should wear them, or flip-flops are okay. Like most things in life, it occurs along a continuum. Some people are okay to wear them and they don't have any problems. Other people have terrible problems if they wear something like that for any length of time.
And somebody else wondered if you had any recommendations for how and where to get shoes fitted properly.
Well, yeah, we just had this conversation. So again, along a continuum, some people, you know, the teenager who has no orthopedic problems that just needs a pair of running shoes can probably go to most sporting goods stores and get a decent fit. The problem comes in if you have foot or ankle or knee problems.
Right. So then it's best to find someone who is probably a certified podorthist. There are shoe stores in major cities. There's plenty in Madison where somebody on staff will be a certified podorthist, and they will be able to really take the time to fit the shoe appropriately and educate you as well as your child, if you're getting them for your child, on what to look for in a quality shoe or what you need to look for. So I have a 14-year-old that has huge bunions. And so we always have to look for shoes with a very wide toe box. And through trial and error, she has found brands that have a tendency to run a little wider. So now we feel comfortable kind of going on our own and finding those shoes. But for the first few times, we went with somebody who had really explained to us what we were looking for in the shoe.
Let's take another call. Greg in Fenimore, thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a pulled groin issue that has been bothering for probably a year now. I had a knee replacement like 9 years ago, and I don't have a good range of motion in that knee. It's only about 90 degrees. And prior to this happening this last time, I've had strains with it before. Like if I'm out hunting or walking through deeper snow, I can't pick that knee replacement. leg up high enough, and so my other leg ends up doing a lot more of the work, and that's when I've strained it. And those times it would last maybe a week or two, and then it would get better, and this time it's just continued and doesn't seem to be healing up. So
do you have a mechanism of injury this time for this episode, Greg?
This time I didn't really, it just sort of came on. It wasn't like I knew a specific event that kind of brought it on like okay. I had previously.
Okay.
And have you seen physical therapists for this?
I haven't seen a physical therapist. I have seen a massage therapist for an other issue, and been working through some of the massage. I'd happened to mention it, and he's like, "Oh, it's probably tender here on the inside of your leg then," and it had been, and I hadn't really tied the two together at that point. But
okay, well, you know. A couple things come to mind. One is, it'd be wise to rule out a hernia, because a hernia can cause groin pain. So just making sure this isn't another medical kind of issue. The second thing we think about ruling out is a condition called osteitis pubis. And that's where you have an inflammation of the joint where your two pubic bones come together. And that's right where your groin muscles attach. And that can become a chronic problem as well. And then sort of the next thing would be, yeah, chronic groin strain or a tendinopathy in the area. So seeing a physical therapist for some specific stretching, strengthening exercises, watching how you move to see if there's a way that you're moving that's putting more load or strain on those muscles, because just treating this each time it flares up is not going to get rid of the problem if you keep doing something that's causing this to get inflamed and flared. So having someone really take a good look at you and how you move, as well as ruling out those other potential confounders, would be important.
Thank you, Greg, for calling. Good luck. Dick in Pewaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I haven't heard you talk about this yet, so I just wanted to bring something up. About 30, 35 years ago, I was having leg problems and pains in my legs, and after a year, the doctor sent me to see an orthopedic surgeon. I'd also been having lower back ache problems quite a bit. They were getting bad. Then he said I had degenerative discs, and in a few years, it would probably get so bad I'd have to have it operated on. I then hired a physical therapist to give a talk at work on lifting. And while I was talking to her before we did the thing, I had mentioned my problem. She told me to stretch my hamstrings and showed me how. It's been 35 years. My back aches went away. My pain in my legs went away. And I've told another number of other people when they were having back problems to try stretching their hamstrings, and quite a few of them has been quite successful. I just hadn't heard you mention the hamstrings and the effect on the lower back.
80% of people with low back pain have tight hamstrings. They're not sure if it's cause and effect, or there's definitely a link to that. So keeping the muscles on the posterior side, specifically the hamstrings, mobile is a really, really good strategy. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, how do you do that?
Well, there's many ways.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do it. Some of it depends upon if you can get up and down off the floor. So I'd say the easiest way and one of the safer ways is lying on your back, putting your hands behind your thigh and pulling your thigh up to 90 degrees and then straightening your lower leg. It's one of the easier ways. I like a seated hamstring stretch. However, you really need someone to show you how to do it, because if you do it without appropriate back stabilization, it can annoy your back. So it's not just stretching your hamstrings, yes or no, but how you do it.
Right.
And one of the reasons we don't say just, oh, stretch your hamstrings, is because if you have an acute sciatica or a nerve issue, sometimes stretching hamstrings can really flare a sciatica.
Right.
So if we're not clear if there's a sciatic component, at least on the radio, we won't say, oh, go stretch your hamstrings and that'll make it better. So it's one of the precautions we talk about. But thank you for sharing that, Dick.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. Appreciate it. Beth in Waukesha emailed. She's an ICU nurse, works 12-hour shifts 3 days a week. For the last 3 months, she's been having pain in her right calf. Starts when she gets up after being seated for 5 minutes or longer. The pain is from the top of the calf down. It's sharp, and her calf feels stiff. The pain goes away a minute or two after she starts to walk. She has been ignoring it, but wondering if you have any suggestions. She's been stretching without any relief.
Well, there are a number of different suspects on that differential diagnosis list. So typically, if people are sitting and then they have pain after they've been sitting or resting, it could be some sort of an inflammation, a tendinopathy. And then once you get going, it's good. So it could be a deep muscle tendinopathy.
Although she doesn't report a mechanism of injury.
Right.
So,
right.
And yes. Then the other option would be vascular.
Vascular. Mm-hmm.
Which was Lori's first thought.
Yeah. So ruling out claudication as an issue. So she's an ICU nurse. Someone should be able to help her sort that out. And then after she gets up and gets the fluid moving through there, then it gets better. So wondering if she's having symptoms at night, which would be another sign of a claudication as a primary issue.
Right.
Mary in Madison, thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. Thank you. I have a shoe size of 8.5 wide around my toes, but and further down from my toes, and I have a normal heel. And I was heard that you were talking about inserts. And where would I buy inserts?
Well, you can get inserts in a number of places. So if you're having foot problems, I would have my foot examined to determine what kind of insert would be best for you. So, for example, if you have a wide foot and a narrow heel and you're buying a shoe to accommodate your wide foot, you may need something like a heel cup to take up some of the space in your heel. If you are having flat feet or things like that, then you may want a different kind of arch support. So again, there's not a one size fits all for foot orthotics or inserts. You really want to match the insert to your specific foot anatomy.
Right, especially since you need space taken up in a certain area. Yeah. So it's not like you need space everywhere. You don't want space taken up by your toes and you need space taken up by your heel. So then the orthoses or the device that we would recommend would be entirely different. And then it's a lot of trial and error.
Right, yep. Right.
Yep. And Julia, do you have a quick question for us? Hi.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. I have a 14-year-old daughter who has two really flat feet. She has just started on a running team and enjoys it, but she is experiencing ankle twisting a lot, ankle spraining. And we were just wondering if there's something that we can do.
Very quickly. I would have her assessed by a physical therapist to look at if she has
systemic
hypermobility, because the combination of flat feet and ankle twisting are really going two different directions. So if she just had flat feet, we'd say, you know, a good arch support, see an athletic trainer. If you have a trainer at your school, about some sort of taping for her feet or arches or whatever. But if she's also twisting her ankle, she may have some systemic hypermobility. I'd want to look at her knees. I'd want to look at her hips, see if her hips are rolling in. And she may need work farther up the kinetic chain. So she's only 14. She wants to run. She likes it. I'd get her seen by a physical therapist for a good assessment.
And on that note, we are out of time. Lori and Jill, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure.
They will be back on September 16th. We'll do this all over again. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum with the University of Wisconsin. Lori is a physical therapist, athletic trainer, and Jill, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. Great to have them with us, and they'll be back September 16th. Tomorrow we'll take a look at back-to-school topics again with our two guests. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.